welcome to Plant Your Geraniums Now, the only podcast focused specifically on when and how to plant your geraniums.
Today's episode, moisture. What is the appropriate level of moisture for your geranium?
Now, Will and I had a heated argument before we started recording because I think there is such a thing as too much moisture.
Which is false. Our guest, do you have any comment on this, our guest, Connor Ratliff?
There is such a thing as too much moisture.
See, you're both full of crap. Plants like two things. They're like you guys are overcomplicating, right? Light and water. That's the secret, okay?
Right. But you can have too much light and too much water.
Oh, give me a break. It's like one of these diet fads which say no carbs, less carbs. It's diet and exercise.
How many times have you come to me crying that you drowned your plants?
It's happened a couple times, but in retrospect, I don't think the water was the problem. I think it was the emotional smothering that I did.
Hi, welcome to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast. Sitting next to me is Will Hines.
Yep, and nestled directly to my left in comfort and bliss is John Frusciante.
I've made a nest.
And we have a special guest, or a regular guest, but he's special as all our guests are special, Connor Ratliff. Hello, Connor.
Hello.
Very special.
Also, we have our podcast intern, Sypha Sounds.
Hey, good evening.
He's applied for several promotions, but we have denied them. He remains the podcast intern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the podcast intern.
Intern's intern.
Yes.
Keaton Patty, who thankfully in this episode is off of the mic.
He's micless. Last time Sypha was the guest, so we had an extra mic and Keaton got it. But now he's back where he belongs.
Never
silenced.
Received so many complaint emails about an episode of the podcast.
It was an onslaught.
I did.
Wanted to say hi, Keaton?
Hey guys, how you doing?
That's enough.
We'll give people a moment to turn the volume back up on their iPods because they probably turned them down violently as soon as they heard
that.
That's
right. So let's get into this. Connor Ratliff, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. You're a longtime listener of this podcast.
That's right.
You're an obsessive. When you like something, you go all in. Audience member, if you're a fan of a TV show or a comedian,
I'm a completist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To an obsessive degree.
Yeah.
To the extent that there are things that I know I would like that I actually avoid sometimes because I'm like, I don't have time. Like, I've never seen an episode of Doctor Who.
Right.
And I know it's because I can't afford it.
It's too big.
It's like 5 years gone. Like, if I were to do that, I'd just be like, oh, it would be like dying early.
This is a community of this type of personality. Like, Sypha Sounds also has this aspect of him, like sort of a hoarder of information and stuff. Mm-hmm. But no one goes to the degree that I've seen you go to. Too.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Is that something that you've always been like?
From an
early age?
Yeah. Like when I was a kid, my dad hosted a TV show where they'd show old Warner Brothers cartoons and things, and I was obsessive about those. Like, I didn't just watch Saturday morning cartoons. Mm-hmm. I would like read Leonard Maltin's book about the history of animation, and I would know, like, oh, this is a Robert McKimson short.
Yeah.
Oh, this is from this era of Walter Lantz. Yeah. And I loved it, but I was very serious about it and very, like...
What are you most obsessive about? I think I know, but I want you to say.
In terms of, like, pop culture things that it would definitely be Elvis Costello.
Right.
But I'm equally obsessive about other kind of comedy or film things. There's, you know, it becomes hard because if I get into like a particular filmmaker, it's like, well, I've got to now own all of their movies. And, you know,
who is a filmmaker you're like that about?
Woody Allen, Steven Soderbergh, John Cassavetes.
Yeah.
With some of them, like when I got obsessed with John Cassavetes movies a few years back, you know, those are like hard work to get through. So it was like, I'm a completist, but like all these movies are exhausting to watch. They feel like work.
Yeah.
And I did genuinely. But so there is a thing where sometimes I will be a little bit reluctant to get interested in something because I realize like it's, oh, if I like that author's book, I'm going to have to read all of their books. You know?
I bring this up because like this is the second era of our podcast. This is podcast 2.0.
Right.
We had podcast 1.0, which we called the UCB Comedy Podcast.
Right, which just went up.
Just went back online.
Yeah.
Because like complicated, but just like typical UCB crazy infrastructure, the servers crashed. We couldn't get them back online. We thought that one thing was going to happen, and it didn't, and just months go by. But
now they're back online.
When they crashed, I didn't have a copy of them, and so I put on Facebook. I didn't want to say – I don't know why. But I didn't want to say like everything crashed and I can't find them. So I just said, hey, does anybody happen to have copies of the old UCB podcast?
Yeah.
And within like 30 seconds, Connor emailed me. He's like, I have all of them. I'll upload them to Google Docs. And then, like, within an hour, I had them all. Like, I thought it was going to be this ordeal where I was going to have to go on the lookout and, like, seek out episodes.
Right.
But no, Connor had them
all. I wasn't the only one, but I was first.
You were first and most organized.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're you would listen to all those episodes. So I know that you're a fan of this and an official archivist.
Is there something – what do you think that is about you? Like, why do you think you do that?
I don't know. I don't think it's anything – OCD or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a touch of that, but it's generally pleasurable. So it's not like a thing where I'm like I've witnessed a number of things recently where I've been around people who are fans of other things I like, and I've noticed a lack of pleasure in it for them. So I went and watched.
You're talking about like the social media criticisms of things?
Yeah, like people who are like equally obsessed with a thing, but they're nitpicky about it and kind of angry or negative or critical about it. Whereas usually even if I have criticisms, that's not. I don't like. I never understand when people are like a big fan of something, but they seem. If you listen to them, it seems like they only have gripes.
Yeah,
and I've
been
because
that
it's sort of like
things.
I think they feel like, well, I love it so much that it should be like as read that I love this, or I wouldn't invest all my time in it.
Or I think the way it feels is you feel like you're being loyal
mm-hmm.
to certain unappreciated aspects, and you're like fighting for them.
Yeah,
you're like, oh, they didn't do this earlier aspect of it, and by criticizing it, I'm showing love.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I think it is misguided and it's dumb. You end up sitting through a movie adaptation of a favorite character, and you can't even enjoy it.
Yeah,
and what's the point?
I've seen it with improv as well too. In terms of like becoming obsessed with improv, but I've seen a lot of people become obsessed, and it becomes like a painful thing for them. Like that, it's really important to them, but they seem to experience only like, oh, I did it wrong, or they'll go and watch other people do it and be like, oh, I don't like that, or I don't, you know. That and to me, it's primarily been a source of pleasure.
Yeah.
And I find it almost hard to relate to, and I have from the very beginning, sort of like people who love something, but it's in a way that it feels like it's kind of eating away at them in an unhealthy way.
Well, let's get into that, because and before we move on, let's do a little just overview of Connor's sort of UCB bio.
Yeah.
Because I think what really, I don't know what Keaton or Seif would say to this, but I feel like what stands out of Connor's UCB career is its incredible trajectory.
Absolutely, yeah.
So Connor showed up on the scene, I mean, a while ago now, but relative to the suddenly ancient UCB history, kind of late in the scene. And then after spending some time taking classes and doing what is a pretty standard route for a talented student, all of a sudden, in quick succession, got put on Herald Night, or actually got put in like great 600 classes.
Yeah.
Indie teams that were in Cage Match, then all of a sudden on Herald Night, then moved to a different team, and then all of a sudden on the Stepfathers, and it's kind of like, who is this guy?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's fun.
That's what you said to me the first day I was in the Stepfathers.
Yeah, I was like, right. Who is this guy?
Yeah, that was your first
meeting. Yeah, I walked into the Stepfathers cloakroom, and I just like set down my martini, and I was like, who's this guy? And I was mystified. It took me a long time to figure it out.
So when was your first introduction to UCB? When did you start?
I started in May of 2009.
Mm-hmm.
I was 33, close to 34 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, you had a whole career as an actor.
Yeah.
And I want to get into that
later.
Yeah,
we'll get to that later.
Just so people know, you had a whole career as an actor, and you had retired and stepped away from the game, which we'll get into. Mm-hmm. And you were a manager of a bookstore. And it had been
Not a manager, just a normal...
Just an employee of a bookstore.
Yeah, just an employee
That's right.
Of a bookstore.
I oversold your
you promoted
day job.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to portray you as such an ambitious person as having been
managed
a manager
his own
of a bookstore.
Right.
Yeah. You worked for Barnes & Noble.
Yes.
And you were done with acting. You were at least very much on hold, if not totally done with it.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're 33, and then May of 2009, how did it come to be that you took a class?
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out – I saw a show – I've lived in New York City since 2002, and so there's, you know, a seven-year span there where I wasn't involved in UCB, and I was aware of it.
Yeah.
But I went and saw a show, I think in 2003 maybe. I can't remember what it was. Mm-hmm. It was a weeknight improv show. I remember thinking it was really good. But then I didn't understand the way the place worked.
Yeah.
I thought, well, they have their own thing. I don't know how that would be.
Yeah.
And
I would never work out there, you told yourself.
I just didn't know what it was. Like, I just didn't. I figured, like, oh, somehow you have to get in this scene. I didn't. I wasn't interested at the time. Mm-hmm. And then a few years later, I was friends with someone who was dating someone who was a performer at UCB.
Yeah.
And she said to me, oh, my boyfriend's doing this spank at UCB. I'm like, what is it? Like, I didn't know what that was. I'm like, yeah. Sure, yeah, I'll come see it. It's a comedy show. And it was Nick Ross, Cool Your J.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember coming and I'm like, I've been to this theater
Nick
before.
Nick Ross, second guest ever of this podcast.
That's right.
Of the original era mm-hmm. that you helped restore, right. Connor. Sorry, go ahead.
Thank and you. Cool Your J was his first one-man show at the theater.
That's right.
Yeah. And I think it was either a spank or – did that have a run? I don't know.
You had a run.
Yeah. It might have been that it wasn't a spank, that it was a –
the debut of its run or something.
Yeah. And I remember at the time being like, I don't understand how these shows work. This is a half-hour show. And that, I remember being really annoyed that there was another show. I'm like, what's this other show?
Yeah.
And I just didn't understand. Like, these shows are short, but they're really good. But what's this other show that I didn't know about?
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, how do these people get their shows here? Like, this is a good theater. This is a good place. And then every time I would ask someone about it, they'd be like, well, you take classes. I'm like, nah, I can't. Like,
yeah.
I was just like, I've been to drama school. I don't want to take any more classes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then I don't remember what sparked me. I think I came and saw a couple other things. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to try and take a class. And I think from the very first class, with my 101 teacher was Betsy Stover. And I remember in the very first class thinking like, oh, this is really hard. Like, this would take a lot of work to get to a point where you could figure it out.
Hmm.
I remember doing something in the first class that – I remember like there were a bunch of people in the class. There were a couple of people in the class who were really trying hard to be funny.
Yeah.
And I remember I did something in like an exercise where I could feel myself trying to be funny. I remember Betsy like sort of like gave me a look kind of like – like, do you really want to do that? Like,
yeah.
It was a little bit of like kind of disappointment.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking like, oh, this feels terrible. Like, I need to like stop trying to be funny. I don't know how to do this. I need to figure it out.
Uh-huh.
And I remember after that first class was done, really having a goal. Like, I want to figure out, because I would go to see shows at the theater and not understand, like, I enjoyed them, but I would not understand how people were doing it.
Yeah.
At all. I was just genuinely like, how did they know to do that? They all did it. And also, I immediately felt like the classes were different than acting classes. I was a little apprehensive because I had so many acting classes in the past that I was kind of like, I don't want to do that anymore. I never felt like I got anything out of acting.
You'd been to
classes.
Two schools, right? The University of Missouri, is that right?
Yeah, I was at the University of Missouri, Columbia.
For
2 years.
Okay.
And then I went to drama school in England in Liverpool. And the thing I noticed about improv classes right away was that it felt like there were practical things that made sense that you could do that made more sense to me than acting class exercises. I felt like, oh, if you do these exercises, it's easier to do scenes that feel good.
So as opposed to like just hippy dippy, airy, nobody can even measure if this is valuable, you felt like there was practical tips
or
practices.
And
or
some of them were just like the training wheels things, like rules that eventually go away.
Yeah.
Don't fight. Say where you are and what you are to each other.
Yeah.
Those were such practical things that like, oh, if you do those, it is easier to figure out what a scene is. Whereas like the thing that I noticed right away, which I always think is interesting to me, is that there, the traps that you kind of identify or that you figure out early on are like that it's easy to do a scene that feels like you're replicating like natural human behavior. And that part is easy, but that can be like, that can lead you down a dead end that's real painful real quick. Like if you do a scene where it's like, hey, how you doing?
Right.
Pretty good. How are you? Can like bullshit for like 45 seconds to a minute
and be correctly imitating human behavior, because that's
like
what happens
accurate, but it's like, oh, then I'm stuck, like we've wasted a minute and I have no good scene. And so there were a lot of things like that that I'm like, oh, these rules make it so that like that scene is interesting.
It's hard for me to imagine you being bad in a class. I feel like you're natural. Like, you're really good. Your instincts tend to be like – I'm on a team with Connor. We're right. both on the Stepfathers. But we've all seen Connor and probably would share some degree of this opinion. Keaton, you probably don't have a positive one because you tend to not be a fan of improv.
Yeah. Getting a big thumbs down. Mm-hmm.
It's not going to work. Improv's not going to work.
Controversial opinion.
Yeah, he believes in improv so little he's only sat here without a microphone for like 15 episodes. But I was going to say, like, it's hard for me to imagine. And you had acting background.
Yeah.
So like – but I we've talked about this, and I know that it was some degree of like figuring things out, and there was a time before it clicked for you, right?
Yeah. Like,
can
I remember
talk about
in,
that?
When I was in 101, I had things that I would do. I – because I was thinking like, well, we've only got like 3 hours a week to do this.
Right.
And we got a class full of people, so there's like limited amount of time to like get up and – do it.
Yeah.
And I remember being – one of my main concerns was like I can't think of what to do in scenes. Like I can't think of
– Yeah.
And I remember thinking like I can't start every scene where I'm digging something.
You know, yeah.
Like, there were like certain things I'm like I don't want to do that. Like I don't want to
– Yeah.
And right. so I would – at home I would drill with the – you know the random word generator. I would drill with that. I would hit refresh on that and I would – with every word that would come up, I would try to see if I could think – honestly think of like two or three possible
yeah.
scenes.
Yeah, I remember
I
doing
do
that. I used to do that.
Just to kind of get past the point to prove to myself I could do it because you know if you – when it's just you, you know if you're cheating. Like you know if – oh, I wouldn't have thought of that in time or like it took me 30 seconds to think of a thing or something.
Yeah,
right.
But I also remember and I never – I had two things that I never used, but I remember employing them as like – I need to do these things to like prepare. One was that I had a scene in my back pocket. I remember the time thinking like I need a scene in case there's a suggestion you can't think of anything.
Yeah.
And I've never done the scene. I never did it, but having it made me feel better.
Yeah.
And I remember a few years later saying like talking to improvisers a few years later and saying like, you know, when you have those scenes and I was like, no, like, I was like, I assumed everyone probably had a scene in their back pocket. And it was just like to comfort me. Like, I know
that is
if
so
nothing
insane.
Else happens,
yeah.
I will have this scene ready. And I knew it was a cheat, but I'm like, it would keep me from ever panicking and thinking like, I don't have anything.
Who right. were your next teachers?
For 201, I had Gil Ozeri.
Uh-huh.
But then he went out halfway through the class. A lot of Ruru was
going
out.
And Kevin replaced?
Chelsea replaced
okay.
for
okay.
that class. And then I had Shannon O'Neill for
that
301.
That was September of 2009 that happened, right? Or August?
Yeah. I went from 101 to 401 between May and December
oh,
of
fast.
2009. Wow. So I literally – this was before they made rules that you couldn't – that prevent you from doing what I did, which was – I was literally like – some of my classes started before the grad show of the – like it – the rule was like if your class ended,
we got stricter
you could start
about
a
this,
new
yeah.
one. And so like literally I would end a class on like a Wednesday, start my next class on a Thursday, and then I'd have the grad show that weekend or something.
Right. There was still – the demand was manageable enough that we were less strict about it.
Yeah.
I had just started my job of running the school at this time. I remember this.
Yeah. And so I
– So Gil Ozeri and Chelsea were your 201.
And then September – October, I was in 301 with Shannon O'Neill, and then before the end of the year, Curtis Gwynn did a couple of classes that had like a weird, like sometimes twice a week. There were like 6 week classes where
yeah.
a couple of weeks were double class weeks.
Right, he was moving, so we were cramming in classes before he left.
Yeah, and I remember I really wanted to take. I was obsessed with Curtis Gwynn for the first year. It was his last year of the theater.
Yeah,
and I remember hearing that he would be like. The teacher that would like make you cry or something like you'd be like
yeah he was a harsh
you.
Yeah
and I was like I need to take like all these teachers are really nice I need to take a class with someone who's gonna like be brutal
yeah
and I
was he
for the first hour of the first class he was
yeah
he came in he like stormed into the class and we were all like oh shit and he was like all right get up, stretch and share. He sat in the corner, and he looked like he was so unhappy to be there. Like, he looked at me, I was like, this guy's mad at us. And so we did stretch and share, and then he was like, all right, two people up. And two people got up, and he was like, no, what are you doing? You can't do that. Sit up. two more people up. And,
so insane.
And so we were like, oh, shit. I was like, I'm not going to – I don't want this anymore. I want it out of here. And so then I remember a couple of people that I was friends with that I just started doing like practice groups with got up and did a couple of people did a scene that he liked, and his mood brightened immediately. He's like, that's a scene. And he's like,
yeah,
that's a great scene. Okay. And so I was like, all right, now we'll see what happens. And yeah. I got up and he liked the scene that I did. And then a couple other people got up. And then from that point on, he was just like completely, everything was fun from that point on. It was never regained that tone of that first hour.
Huh.
There was a class, I remember this is one of my favorite classes that that I ever had, because it I think he was like sort of throwing a little bit of the curriculum. Maybe I don't know this for sure, but
there wasn't a curriculum in 401.
There wasn't one.
Okay. Oh no, there was one, but
I got the
it was new-ish.
Yeah, around that time. Yeah.
I got the feeling, and this could be just what it I was reading into it. I got the feeling that because Curtis was about to leave, he was just kind of like, "I'm doing what I want in this."
That's
class.
Probably true.
Yeah, I think that was
that's
true.
That's probably accurate.
Yeah. Because I would talk to other people who are in 401, they're like, that's not what we're doing at all. And he would have us do a lot of stuff where we would do heralds where you kind of have like one hand tied behind your back. So we'd do like a dramatic herald or a backwards herald. And I was finding that really helpful because you stop worrying about the
you're focused
the
on
things.
This. Right, right, right.
You're focused on the gimmick and you – and there was a class where he had us do a bat, a herald in the dark. And he split us into two halves. And I was with the first half and we did we did one that was fine. Afterwards, he was like, "Have any of you ever done that before?" And we were like, "No." And he's like, "Okay, well then that was pretty good."
Yeah.
And so the second half got up, and they did a scene painting opening, and I mean we both did. And but in the second half, they somehow got onto a very anti like a very all the games were like homophobic.
Yeah.
And there was something where it was like a bar that was named like faggot or something like that.
Yeah.
And then they started doing, when they started doing the scenes, one of the first beats was like two guys who were homophobic but wanted to go to this bar that was called faggot, but they were also secretly gay but didn't want to admit it to
each
other.
Right.
And we're listening. We're in the dark, so it feels more intensified. It was like this sweaty room. And then in the second beats, their heightening of that was two guys who were going to the Jew killing store. And there's no laughter from anyone in the class at this point.
Yeah.
And
of course not.
That's not a thing.
Right.
And and then when they got into group game. There was a group game that had to do with like, because I think there was only one woman in the class. It was a very guy heavy class.
Yeah,
and she was in this half it. And in one of the group games, it was like they were playing a game where it was like she was like a girl in a classroom and she was presenting something, and all the guys in the classroom were like, "She's too fat. We can't see the chalkboard." So this is like the whole tone of this.
That
was really like mean spirited. And none of these were like mean people. They were just going to,
I've been there. I think you get trapped into those.
And I think being in the dark, I think it also like did something like, it made everyone like, "Oh, it's a forbidden herald or something." And then when they got to third beats, I will never forget this initiation from the third beats. One of the third beat initiations was mixing the – because one of the people who was in this half was Opus Mureshi.
Sure.
And he
– current head writer
of the Colbert Report.
He kept doing moves to try to like correct – because he's like – if you know him, he's a really – kind-hearted person.
Yeah.
This is not his kind of comedy.
Right, right.
And he kept doing moves that were like, and pause. Okay, that's a videotape of the way not to treat people when they're doing class presentations.
And
I remember the group immediately said,
"Undoing that.
We can't see the video. She's too fat."
Yeah.
So they immediately were like de-correcting all of his.
Right, right.
And in the third beats, someone initiated a scene that was blending the obese girl student and the offensive stores, and it was the initiation was Welcome to the Obese Women Rape Factory.
Factory?
Factory. I guess it makes sense as a heightening of Jew-killing store.
Yeah, so, right.
Thing that doesn't make sense with offensive thing.
Right, yeah. It's a good, like, Mad Lib heightening.
And so in the third Beats, they got to a final scene in the third Beats, and someone says, I remember it was Opus's line in one of the scenes was, he goes, well, I guess there's some things you just can't teach. And then Curtis turned the light on and goes, don't I know it. And he walked across the room and he sat down. And then he goes, guys, that was awful. That was like I was trapped in a room with everybody I ever hated in high school.
Yeah.
And they were making me listen to their bad improv. And then he like gave like a 45-minute lecture about where he said, let's talk about this, like why this didn't work. Like you can't just put nihilism up on the stage. Like he goes, you can do anything you want. I'm not here to tell you you can't do something in an improv. Like I've done everything. I'll do anything in an improv scene. But there's gotta be a reason for it.
Yeah.
And it was like fascinating because like he like made them feel appropriately kind of like
shamed
for what they'd done. But by the end of the class, I feel like everybody had more of an understanding of like, you know, there's a little bit of like, I think because of my age, I was noticing a thing of like nice guys in the class who were funny, who were like, oh, these guys were like 8 when South Park came around.
Yeah.
And I'm like, their like baseline is like, oh, you can do jokes about anything.
Yeah.
Whereas I had a little bit of a different generational point of view on it, in the sense that like I know that South Park's supposed to be shocking, and that I feel like there, if I would have seen it as a little kid, maybe I wouldn't think of it as
right. Shocking. You're desensitized a little bit.
Yeah,
it's interesting to call it nihilism. Like that's a pretty sophisticated way to categorize that.
Yeah,
nihilism. Like to put all this kind of aim. It's just. It's not that it's hateful. It's empty, is what it is.
Yeah, because none of the
like
people
he's
in that
on
class
a team with Anthony Tamanic. He had probably just done his like 2-person mono scene where they're on the planes about to hit the World Trade Center, which is one of their mono scenes.
Yeah.
So he's certainly been thrown into offensive or dangerously territory that could be very offensive.
Right, and I think that speaks to his point that you can make, you know, these kind of
like
dangerous, risky, potentially offensive moves, or bring these kind of touchy subject matter and content things into improv, but as you relate it, there has to be a reason for it. It can't just be like,
and because none of the people in that class, like they're all good people. It's not like anyone there was,
they weren't bullies.
I've talked to people who are in that class. Every time I meet up with someone or run into someone who's in that class, I always want to talk about that class. But it was just like they weren't thinking why. They were just thinking like, oh, I've seen people do scenes like this. I'll do a scene like this. So it was kind of almost like the way like, you know, as beginning improvisers, a lot of stuff you'll do. I've done stuff where it's like almost like a child imitating what you've seen
someone
do. Like if you go and watch like Anthony Tamanic or Shannon O'Neill or someone like that, there are things that they can get away with that not every improviser can get away with.
Yeah.
And it's partly because of some of it is, you know, there's like a charm to certain improvisers have a charm that they can get away with more than others.
Totally. Yeah. And
No.
I was just going to say I did so many things early on as an improviser because I thought they were things that Besser would do. You know, I would go see ASCAT and I like idolized Matt Besser and I would be like, you know, just like I think it's a formative phase for everybody's improv development is like you see the people that you really like and are drawn to and you think like, oh, yeah, I know how to do that.
Yeah.
And you don't realize until years later that you didn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but it was really, I mean, stuff like that, those are the classes that I really remember where things, a lot of the lessons that make you get a little bit better are very painful when they're actually happening. Like, I wasn't in that half, so I didn't have the direct experience of it.
Yeah.
But I was in a locked room with the lights off.
So
it felt intense to a degree that I might as well have been doing it.
Let's talk about getting good. Let's talk about like breakthroughs or moments where it started to feel better for you.
I remember the first moment where I felt like something happened. Because the other thing I did, having a back pocket scene, the other thing that I did was I bought a bunch of Three Stooges DVDs and my thought was that I bet there'd be scenarios that were in those that people don't use anymore, like we're clock cleaners, or you know, we're like, you know, like they'd have jobs
like just who, what, wheres,
yeah,
that you like could use.
That I could, clock cleaners. I never used any of those, but it was during the phase where I was like, I need to have more stuff in my head,
right?
And rather than being well educated, rather than just learning more stuff, which is really the secret weapon of a lot of it.
Yeah.
I was like, I got to think of more scenarios or something. I remember in 201 doing a scene where there was a scene someone was doing, where, a child had broken a thermometer and eaten the mercury. That was the scene. And so the guy was panicking,
yeah,
and he was calling 911, and 911 was like, being difficult or stalling,
right, right,
or whatever.
Improv 911.
Yeah, and so I thought I would. I didn't execute the move of it correctly, but I wanted to be the 911 people showing up. I just wanted to like move it ahead.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd done something to trigger like that. I was tagging out the phone call, but the guy who was on the phone didn't communicate that. So
yeah,
the guy stayed on the phone. And he goes, and I went to like ding dong, like knock the door or whatever. And then he was like, oh, hold on, someone's here. And I was like, oh, shit. I was going to be the 911 person.
Yeah.
And now I can't because it's too soon. at the time, I was like, not realistic. I couldn't just
be
the 911 operator. And so he opened the door, and I was like, shit, what do I do? Like,
yeah,
I had a move, and now I can't do it because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And without thinking, I said, hello, I'm selling thermometers. I think it was – and I remember at the time –
Wait, there was kids choking on mercury and you're selling thermometers?
Yeah, so I was just like, a kid had broken a thermometer. And I didn't think about it, but afterwards I remember being like impressed that it had happened. I didn't credit myself. I didn't feel like I had done it.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, that's funny. Like the one – it solves the lesser problem in the scene.
Yeah.
That his thermometer's broken.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking like, how do I get that to happen again? Because I couldn't make it happen again.
Yeah.
In other scenes, I'd be like, it's not coming. Like there was just like a magical, because I remember it got a laugh and it felt like, oh, this is what this is supposed to be. Like it's supposed to feel
right.
Like you're, it was the first time that the don't think thing made sense because I'm like, I didn't think of that. It just happened. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But.
How about, let me ask you this. Like at this point, had you started to feel like, because you had quit acting,
yeah,
or you had taken a break from it or whatever.
Yeah.
At this point, or was there a point where you started to feel like, oh, okay, like I'm kind of into this again? Or were you approaching it from a completely different way?
It always felt different. Eventually it started to, it felt like, oh, my acting my acting training helps,
mm-hmm,
some things that other people were maybe struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so focused on like making scenes that didn't, that where things happened,
mm-hmm,
and I didn't understand game.
So you were coming at you had a pretty humble posture despite your experience.
Yeah, in the first class, I had one moment where I think I even may have gotten a laugh on the thing that
Betsy gave me the eye about,
a look about.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember thinking like, I don't want that laugh. Like it does. I don't know what I'm doing. And when I go see Harold Knight, I see a bunch of people that I think know what they're doing.
Right.
And
you didn't necessarily have any bigger goals with this other than just thinking it was fun and wanting to do it and wanting to get good at it.
I didn't – like I enjoyed the 101 grad show. I couldn't believe that we were actually on the stage where we did – where I'd watch shows happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking it was fun to do a show. And I just wanted to figure it out. Like I just wanted to – I've never had like a – I always enjoyed the classes. I enjoyed even the things that were difficult. And I could feel progress happening even when it felt slow. I could feel like, I bet if I keep taking classes, there'll be this like steady feeling of like feeling more comfortable in it. I remember in 301 starting to do practice groups. I didn't do indie shows until I was already at advanced study. I never did an indie show.
Mm-hmm.
I still feel like sometimes I don't have an understanding of the way certain structures work within the community.
Mm-hmm.
Like people will know about stuff. I'm like, how do you find that out? I still feel weirdly sometimes like the last person to know the way certain things work.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I'd gotten through, after the Curtis class, forming my first indie team, which was Secret Man Group, which is a lot of people are on teams now. Matt Cohen, Peter Shearer, Adam Conover. Opus was in it for a few months, but we didn't do a show with him. he just was like, practice with us every week, and then he got on Herald Night, and then we're like, oh, you don't have time for this. And Brian Polk. That was the initial lineup of the team.
Mm-hmm.
And our first practice session, I remember Terry Withers coached us, and he said, okay, yeah, get up and just do some scenes. And we did some scenes and kind of laughed a little, and then he was like, okay, that was good. Do you guys do shows?
Yeah.
And we were like, no, we don't do shows. He's like, yeah, I think you should do shows. And after that practice, none of us understood the way the indie scene worked. It was like he had said we were a Herald team. He was like, Terry Withers from Herald Night thinks we should be doing shows. And we were so like excited about it. And I remember when we started doing shows, it feeling like a really big deal. Like, this is fun. Like, this feels like the thing I want to be doing. Because I think a lot of it, in some ways, I felt like when I was an actor, the more I worked in show business, the further I kept getting from the thing I liked about acting when I was doing it for fun as a kid.
Uh-huh.
And the more it got into like, oh, you're going to audition for this play. Oh, this play is no good. And then it's like, I don't want to be in this play. And well, they'll pay you. And it's like, this is not what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And discovering UCB and doing improv at UCB was the first thing that I had as an adult where I felt like, oh, this is why I liked it. Like, this is what I liked about doing plays growing up and in college and in drama school. That feeling of like having a creative outlet that were like working with good people. 'Cause that's the other thing is like, the talent bar is so high at UCB that it was like, oh, if you can get through this gauntlet of training and you can figure it out, then guess what? You get to perform all the time with out of like a pool of people who are all really good.
Mm-hmm.
That was just so appealing to me because when you're trying to be an actor, like briefly in New York, I tried being an actor. I was an actor in England, and then when I moved to New York, I maybe tried for a year. I was like, it feels miserable. Like, you put on a play, no one comes to see it because you're in New York City. Your play is like an actor's equity showcase, so you have to charge a minimum ticket amount, which makes it like, oh, now we're competing with actual things that you're in New York. You could go see the greatest things that there are.
Yeah.
Right.
And UCB was a place
Alan Cumming's
like,
doing Macbeth, or we can see Conor Ratliff and his friends do a deconstruction of an Ibsen play.
Yeah. Yeah. And to me, one of the appealing things about UCB was like, oh, all the shows here are $5 and $10.
Yeah.
So the worst show you ever go see at UCB, I would say the worst show I've ever seen at UCB, still pretty good and still like a bargain.
Yeah.
Like, and almost everything I've ever seen at UCB has been like, I can't believe I saw that for $5 or $10.
Yeah.
Like the whole first year of going to see Ruru every Saturday night, I was like, I don't care that I'm not getting in a weekend show with my class card, like with my student card.
Yeah.
Because I can't believe that in New York City you get to go see Death by Ruru for $10.
Yeah.
And they let you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the greatest shows ever, Death by Ruru.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
You talked to me once about how Eliza's class was one where you kind of had a breakthrough, and then I know that Gethard's class was really important.
Yeah.
Although actually, and Neil Casey was the first person who ever mentioned you to me. You did the movie class with Neil.
Well, I did my first Ash, one of the first Advanced Study Herald classes.
Yeah.
Which I annoyed everyone at the time by refusing to call it. That was when they changed them from calling them
501s to Advanced was my, Study Herald. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. That was my decision. It hasn't worked.
And I would feign ignorance whenever anyone would say it was a 501.
Yeah.
I'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. And deliberately annoying to people. Right after 401, I had musical improv with Eliza Skinner. And that was the first class where I felt like I was actually starting to get good. Like, that was the first class where I started to feel like I was turning like that I was in a new level than what I'd been at before.
Was there something specific about that class?
There were a couple of things. One was, I think it was the fact that you're so concerned about you're having to come up with lyrics and music that it forced me to like actually not think about all the things that I learned in 101 through 401. So it was a real good way of like I was so focused on the musical part that you just like, well, I got to do improv that's good because I got to focus on this song. And so it sort of like it was a really good muscle memory class. Kind of in a similar way later when I took the movie class, that one's really good for like not having the control of initiating your own scenes. Like if you're established as like the mayor, the villainous mayor in the opening of the movie, then the rest of the show when people are like, we cut to the mayor at a spaghetti factory, you're like, well, I don't have an idea for the scene, but I have to do it because they just said it basically is a form of they're just like, hey, Connor, go do a scene now. It's this character. And you have to do it. But in the musical – I think Eliza was also – there was one point in the class where she said something that simplified something. She was like – someone did a move in a scene and she asked the person like, did you think that would be like the most fun thing you could have done? Was that fun for you when you did that move? And they're like, no. Why'd you do it? And they're like, well, I thought I was supposed to – I should do something like that. And she was sort of emphasizing like this should be fun for you. Like you should be not just doing stuff out of like the feeling like of obligation like, oh, this is the correct move to do. Like there should be an element of enjoyment in it, which was – it's in some ways is a really obvious thing. But I do feel like there is that thing of like improvisers who aren't enjoying doing improv – it almost doesn't matter how skilled they are.
Yeah.
Right.
Like even if they're doing technically good improv, if someone doesn't enjoy doing it, you can feel it. Like an audience can sort of tell.
Yeah.
And it's almost like preferable to see someone who's really into it, who's maybe doing less than letter perfect improv.
Yeah.
If they have an enthusiasm about it, I feel like.
Yeah. So that was one of the things you learned in that class.
Yeah.
And then so you simplified it. You embraced fun more. Then we got Neil's movie class was next.
I had the Advanced Study Herald with Neil.
And that was with Tom Levin and Starzynski. Was it that class?
That was that one, yeah.
And Will Cooper and those guys?
Yeah.
I remember that was a really strong class
Catherine
that Neil
Udon
liked.
Was in that class.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I also started realizing – I kept having the experience all through classes of like – feel it really screwed up my sense of how old I am.
Yeah.
Because I would frequently assume I was the same age as other people. And sometimes I would think – some of the worst was when I would think like, oh, that person's older than me. And then find out they were like 7 years younger.
Yeah, right.
or literally like there was – I remember there were times where I'd be like, oh, you're 20. You know, and you don't understand anything I'm referencing. Neil's class and then I took a second musical improv class and then – I think the movie was the next thing.
Yeah.
And that was with Neil and Dynamo.
Right.
And they would like switch off classes. So in those classes, you would go from a class where everyone was terrified of Dynamo and then Neil would come in and would be generously laughing at everything. And that one was a really interesting experience because there were people in the class who you could tell were like they would be so petrified of the classes that Dinah was teaching.
Yeah.
Because – if she liked something, it was rewarding. But if she didn't like something, she wasn't afraid to just blatantly let you know.
Yeah.
Don't do that again.
Yeah, right.
And then I guess after that, I took an Anthony King Advanced Study Herald that was focusing on Advanced Study Performance class that was focusing on the Herald. And this was in January of 2011. And I took that class because normally they would focus on weird forms. It would be like the movie or the vantage point or different things like that.
Yeah.
And it was Anthony King, artistic director of theater, and it was a performance class focusing on the Herald. And I thought, oh, that means Herald auditions will be in April and this will be like boot camp for Herald. And I thought – because I auditioned for Herald Night in 2010. I didn't get a call back. And I just did it because I didn't expect a callback. I did it because I wanted to see what the auditions were like.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to wait a year and then realize like, oh, I didn't know they were like that. I could have prepared myself. And so I took the Anthony King class thinking like, oh, this will prepare me for Herald Editions. And then like a week before that class was supposed to start, I got – there was a day where they added a bunch of people. And I saw like, oh, Noah Foreman, Arthur Meyer, who else was added that day? A Love Band. And
was Phil Jackson added that day or is he later?
I think he was maybe a little later.
Okay.
But I saw three people have been added to Herald Night. And I was like, that's great. And I, as usual, was like ready to make my reservation. I made my reservation for Herald Night on the website. It was Wednesday morning.
Yeah.
And like 40 minutes later, I got a phone call I didn't recognize, so I let it go to a message. I was at work. And then I listened to the message. It was from Anthony King. And I thought, oh, there's a problem with the class.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's something where he like, he has some information, something we need to prepare for the class. And then I called him back and he said, this is Anthony King. I wanted to offer you a slot on Herald Night. And I remember pausing and being like, okay, just say yes. Like, don't, like I felt like you could ruin this. Like, I did feel like there was a possibility that I could be like, fuck you or something like that.
It would just come out.
Like, I don't want it. Because I didn't. I was genuinely like, I'm not – this makes no sense to me. Like I genuinely felt like at that time, like I don't know how heralds work. I hadn't done a herald since like the previous spring, I think.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know second beats. I don't understand. Like I genuinely felt like I don't understand these things enough. I still go to Herald Night and don't know what they're doing. And so I just remember pausing and I remember going, yes. I remember being really careful, like, and he's like, okay, well, here's your, and then I remember thinking, like, I just made reservations to go see the show, and now I'm going to be in the first team, like, I'm going to be, the next Herald that I was going to see, the next Herald that will happen at the theater, I will be in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, which I remember thinking at the time, like, that's weird, it's rare that anyone ever buys a ticket for a show, and then finds out they're in the show.
Yeah.
So
crazy.
Yeah, so
yeah, that's fast. I guess that's not insanely fast, but it's faster than you thought.
It's pretty fast. And then like so you were on Herald Night and it was so how long were you on Herald Night for?
I was on Herald Night for 8 months.
Okay.
And I was on Capture for a few months. That was a fun team.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like we were just getting going, and then we got mixed up, and Capture was like half of Monstro, half of the opera,
yeah.
And then me and Eddie Brawley.
So then after 8 months, you get invited to...
I was on Dance Break for a few months. Capture got broken up, right. I was on Dance
right.
Break.
Mm-hmm.
And then at one point, I was in parentheses, which was the Gethard class, which was like 28 people,
yes.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
And Gethard asked me to do – one night we were at McManus after
Chris
one of the
Gethard,
shows.
Chris Gethard, we should say, for anybody
Christopher
listening.
Gethard.
Yes.
Asked me if I wanted to do two-prov at the Creek. I was like, sure. Yeah. But I felt really weird because I'm like, I'm in a class of like 27
yeah.
other people. I was like, why do you want to do two-prov with me? And we did a couple of like mono scenes at the Creek. And then he asked me to sit in for the Stepfathers, which I thought was like, oh, this is – what a fun, like, I thought...
like a treat.
That right. would be a one-time thing. Literally, like, a year earlier, I'd gone to see... there was a Gethard show where they had, like, raffles, where it was, like, for the March of Dimes, and you could enter to win prizes, and one of them was...
just for people who don't know, Chris Gethard, who is one of the top performers and teachers of the theater, and the Stepfathers did the Chris Gethard show, which is now a big public access show.
Mm-hmm.
That feels weird to say, but it is a big public access show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and... yeah.
And now going to be a pilot at Comedy Central. Started as a stage show at UCB every...
that's right.
month, and he would always do some, not always, but pretty often do a pretty elaborate show or something. And so you're talking about the raffle
yeah.
to play with the Stepfathers.
There was a raffle to play with the Stepfathers, and I bought a ticket for that, and I put Tom Levin's name on it, and I sat back down, and I told Tom, I put your name on that, because he had entered to win one. I said, I put your name on my ticket. He's like, why didn't you put your name on? And I remember I said to him, no, I can't do that. I don't deserve to be on the stage with this. I didn't say it in a sad way. I just was like, very matter of fact, like, there's no way. So I did feel a little very weird sitting in with the Stepfathers initially. But I really genuinely, I sent him once, and then there was like a week later, he like called and I missed the message. I was in a movie, and yeah. And I was like, oh, I could have done it a second time. And then a few weeks later, he asked me to sit in and he like told me in advance. And I remember thinking like, oh, this is fun. I'm glad I got to do this. But being genuinely like stunned afterwards, like I'm still stunned by it. It doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I feel like I found my rhythm on the team. I feel like I found my place on the team. But I do have this weird, like, upstairs, downstairs feel in terms of, like, I did too soon. Like, it was too fast.
Yeah, it was fast.
Like, it feels like a lack of propriety. Like, it feel like there's a part of me that does feel a little bit like... I remember being at the Creek a few weeks after getting put on the Stepfathers, and there were a bunch of members of DeCoster there. I think it was at a point where DeCoster had been, like, I think broken up?
Maybe, yeah.
There was a point, I remember being where I was like, I'm the person in this room who's on a weekend team right now, and it felt really like offensively bad.
Yeah,
because I was looking at like Ryan Carls and people like that, and who were in the room. And I think it was before
Ashes, yeah.
Before Grandma's
or maybe Ashes was just a Herald team and new maybe at that.
Yeah, I remember thinking like, oh, this is like embarrassing. Like I shouldn't be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, I was in the room when that decision when the Stepfathers added you, and it is a weird thing. Like when someone is a good fit, it isn't necessarily, and we. Of course, you're very good,
mm-hmm. Right.
But you're not picking the absolute best sum of possible improv skills. You're picking people who are above a certain line, good, right. Who fits.
Yeah,
and it's also,
and I think because you're older,
yeah,
because the Stepfathers are a bunch of old people like me and Delaney. So not that we didn't like say that, let's get somebody old, but I think that was part of the reason why. Oh, yeah. and someone who's had a life before,
right?
Yeah,
and it didn't just. Blended with the people who'd had like lives before UCB.
Yeah.
And something like, I don't know. Gethard was the one who brought it up. You and I were friends at that point.
Yeah.
But I must admit, I did
we
not.
We were Jimmy Corrigan, Chris Ware Comics, Elvis Costello friends.
Yeah, we were nerd friends.
Yeah.
But Chris did, and I think we knew that it was early. But yeah. We saw the trajectory you were on, and it was kind of like, well, he's really good. If we don't get him now, Ruru's going to get him. I feel like when Ruru added Mike Still, whenever that happened, which at that point had been like a year and a half before, the Stepfathers were like, we could have gotten Mike Still.
Yeah.
Like Mike Still would have been really good for us. Like he's a good actor. He commits. Like we have a bunch of think bots and Mike would have like shaken things up, but still been like really analytical and we didn't get him.
We didn't
even think about it.
You made a vow to never let another bearded man.
We were like, the next time a bearded, slightly broken man comes along, we're gonna grab him early. So it was sort of like, well, is Ruru gonna grab Connor? Mm-hmm. Like Neil really loves Connor, and I was like, oh yeah, Neil's always raved about him, you know, and like he was in the movie class, and then that kind of snowballed. We're like, maybe we should ask him right now, like something like that happened. And I remember Anthony King called me the next day. He's like, you guys grabbed Connor? He's like, that was a smart move. Remember he said that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but he was surprised also. Like it was earlier than like our culture would say is appropriate.
Yeah.
But there's
there's no rules. It's if it feels right, you make the move.
Like with anything else, you know, success around here is not like a line of people waiting to get on an escalator. It's like the subway pulls up and the doors open and you get on whenever you can.
It was great. You were great right away.
That's a good analogy. It's true. It's true.
And Cyphus has good analogy.
That's a good analogy.
It's true. And it's a tough thing to...
It's a good way to visualize it.
It really... I mean, it's a tough thing to really like... bite into and hold on to, but it's true. You, I mean, if you're anything like me, you tend to think like, well, life should be fair.
It should be predictable and measurable.
Right, right. And it should
go,
be like, we all line up for success, but that's not the way anything in life. Well, it's not the way most things in life work.
Yeah.
It's not the way anything works around here. At UCB,
the only thing that works like that is an escalator.
Yeah.
Right. But it's true. An elevator can kind of be the same way. Like elevator doors open and like somebody gets on before you and you're like, what are you doing? You fucking
here.
Asshole. I'm standing right here. And it's just like, no, somebody just saw an opportunity and they took it, you know? And that's the way that life kind of works. And that's kind of what you have to do. You know, you just have to like,
keeping with the analogy in the UCB community, what are the people who stand on the left when you should be using the left to walk up the escalator?
Probably the people who like say that they love improv but just complain about it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't have a whole lot of time left here, but like, let's talk a little bit about your acting experience and your acting life. So you said that you were an actor in England.
When growing up, I did a lot of plays. I'll just throw this in. This just as a fun, since this is an improv podcast, I feel like this is a fun piece of weird trivia, which is that my dad, he was in one of Del Close's improv groups in 1971, I think.
Really?
Pre-Belushi.
Yeah.
Pre-Rockstar Del.
He'd been, I think, fired by the Second City, and he started a group called the Chicago Extension. And that was where he was, like, developing the Herald. So when I was growing up, my dad would mention, like, I'd hear the name Del Close, like American Graffiti would be on TV or something like that. And my dad would be like, oh, that's Del Close. I'd be like, that means nothing to me.
Yeah.
And, but it was never at the front of my mind in terms of, there are weird things that you realize, like, oh, like, I'm doing this, and this is what my dad did at one point. And he did it, I think, for like a year in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like growing up, I always did plays and things like that. And, I did a couple years where I was, I was a theater major, I was an acting major at the University of Missouri Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really like the acting training. Like, I liked doing the plays, but I was looking for a change. I was looking to find a new school, and it was sort of like timing wise, I was impatient and I wanted to like not miss a semester. And I saw a thing in USA Today saying that Paul McCartney was opening a Fame school in England and that Elvis Costello would be teaching there. And so I wrote away for information just to find out, like, what's he teaching? Not that I was going to ever take a class. Yeah. I just wanted to know what was going on. And when I got the brochure, it said McCartney was putting, like, millions of dollars of his own money into, like, turning his old, like, primary school into an entertainment, like a show business school. And the whole point would be like to train you for a career in the arts. And it included acting was one of the majors. And you get your degree in 3 years, you get your bachelor's degree. Because in England, they don't waste time doing general ed in college. Like you've been properly educated.
Right.
And so I sent away for a thing. I flew to New York and auditioned for it. And then I did a 3-year acting training thing in England.
Mm-hmm. And did you find that you were having success as an actor in England?
Immediately, like my thought was I would be in the first graduating class.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought this school will need to have people be successful or it will go out of business. So I thought like they'll help, they'll push.
Mm-hmm.
And I was right. Like I got an agent right out of school. A bunch of people did. And there's a lot of attention on it. I got into a really good play at the Royal Court Theater within weeks of moving to London. I had this agent. I was auditioning for stuff, and I got the lead in a play called Four by Christopher Shin, which just got there was just an indie movie made of it with Wendell Pierce from The Wire. It was a play in which I played a gay teenager who meets with a middle-aged black college professor for a sex date. I didn't tell my parents. I forgot to tell my parents what the play was like, what happens in the play.
Yeah.
So my family all came to see the play. And during the scene where I am in the hotel room and I'm about to be, I take off my shirt and I lay down on the couch. And then the black college professor starts like rubbing me and saying like, you're a good boy, June, you're a beautiful boy. And the lights are like slowly fading. And
yeah.
I remember thinking like, oh, like I should have told my parents that this play so they would know what was happening.
Heads up. Yeah.
And then I did a couple, like I did some commercial stuff and I auditioned for a bunch of stuff. And then I got cast in Band of Brothers and then was fired from Band of Brothers by Tom Hanks.
You didn't know that story, Cypher?
That was while I was in England.
That's part of the Ratliff lore.
Yeah, how much of that story are you comfortable talking about?
I'll tell the whole thing if we got 2 minutes. I got a little part in episode 5 of Band of Brothers. I played, I think it was Private Zelinsky was the name of the character. And it was basically just like the T-boy. I come in and I tell... the actor who plays Brody on Homeland. It was that guy. I was going to be telling him, like, his character gets promoted, and my character was, like, a symbol of, like, his relative comfort. Like, he has a guy who's like, do you need any more coffee or tea? Do you need anything? And it was just, like, a couple of perfunctory lines. But it had, like, several scenes. I was always going to be, like, following his character around. And then I found out, like, good news, Tom Hanks is personally directing your episode. I thought, that's great. Like, what could be better? Like, I'm in Band of Brothers, and yeah. Tom Hanks is going to direct me. And then – so I went down, they cut my hair, fit me for the costume and everything, and then I was getting ready to go down to London from Liverpool and film this thing for a few days. And then I got a call from my agent the day I was going down saying, you need to get down to London immediately. I'm like, I got a train ticket for later today. Like, no, now. You need to get down there now. Tom Hanks saw your audition tape, and he thinks you have dead eyes. He wants you to you have to come down and read for Tom Hanks. And I was already, like, I was hired. It wasn't like an audition, but it was like a re-audition for it.
How are you feeling at this point on the
terrible,
way down there?
Terrible, because I'm like, how? Because I knew, like, it, I didn't have like an audition speech where I could be like, they tell you it's going to be different, but it isn't. Like, I didn't have like a big right. emotional thing. It was like, do you need any coffee or tea? and I'm thinking, like, how can I, like, make my eyes really pop in the room with Tom Hanks without it being bad acting? Like, there's no way to, like, yeah. he doesn't like you, prove him wrong.
Yeah.
And so it was, like, a four-hour train ride down from Liverpool to London. And then I met with the casting director, and there was a – I had a driver who picked me up before when – I had this guy named Bernie who was my, like, limo driver who had driven me the time before when I went down to get a costume fitting. Uh-huh. I felt like, oh, this is so luxurious. I have a driver. I'm an actor. I'm in this thing. And now he's, like, driving me up for this horrible re-audition. And so I waited in the room, and everyone was so nervous around me. It was all these, like, British, like – production people and casting people who they had all hired me. Mm-hmm. And now they were like, you know, they kept coming up to me and being like, you do know what this is about, don't you? And I'm like, yeah, yeah, I know. And they're like, oh, good, good, good. And but they were clearly like uncomfortable with it. And then at a certain point, I hear
they're uncomfortable with like
the
what?
Situation. Right. Because they had, you know, they'd hired me.
Right.
And now here I am, probably about to be fired.
And they're uncomfortable with the way he's reacting to it.
I think they're just Britishly uncomfortable right. around me. Like, oh, like this is the man anything. Who's about to be killed.
Right.
and so there's a certain point where I waited then in an office for hours for Tom Hanks to get back from. He was doing like a location scout or something. And I hear in the other room, like, and I hear this noise. And I'm like, oh, shit, like, Tom Hanks is here. And so I go into, they're like, oh, he's ready for you now. And so I go in, and Tom Hanks is sitting on a little couch, and he's at his end of Castaway weight. Like, so he's thin, but he's doesn't have the Castaway beard and long hair. So he looks like end of the movie Castaway, but he's got a little bit of, like, sort of gray stubble, and he's, like, super thin. And I come in, he's like, oh, hey, how you doing? And, said, all right, well, yeah, let's do this. And so I read with a producer. The producer has all the lines in the scene because it's a scene where I'm mostly saying, like, yes, sir. No, sir. Will you be needing any coffee? Yes, sir. And, like, that's the scene. The other guy's, like, talking. The producer's, like, woodenly reading all the lines.
Right. Think about war as it tests your soul.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And so we end the scene, and Tom Hanks goes, is that it? Oh, I wish there were more. And I was like, oh, okay, he's laughing. That's going to be good. And then he's like, all right, well, thanks a lot. He shakes my hand, and I leave the room, and I go sit down. And then I wait for, like, probably about 5 or 10 minutes. Felt like a really long time. And then the casting director comes out, and she kneels down in front of me, and she goes, they've decided to go another way.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
And I immediately I'm like, I've already spent some of the money, and because I was like genuinely thinking like maybe I wouldn't get paid. Now, but they're like, no, don't worry. Like you the contract's signed. You'll still get paid. I'm like, okay, all right. And so I get back into the car, and Bernie, like, drives me back down. And Bernie was to be my driver for, like, a few days originally. And I remember I was I had this place that I was staying at in London for the week, and he drops me off there. I remember Bernie saying to me, shall we be seeing you tomorrow? And I said, no, Bernie, we shan't be seeing each other. And then I just wandered around London for the week, and the Green Mile was out, so there were all these giant posters of like the most noble looking. And then if you watch Band of Brothers, all the lines got cut. All my characters' lines got cut anyway. They told me that they were going with a more military type.
Yeah,
but the guy who's in it looks like Elmer Fudd. I mean, I think I may very well have had dead eyes in the tape. I've seen it before.
Yeah,
but. It felt bad.
Yeah, I mean, how do you get over something like that? I mean, how do you process that?
That wasn't the reason I stopped acting, but I was getting ready to move back to America anyway at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it provided a point where I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to take a break from this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I lived in Oregon, I worked with my best friend's preschool for a year and a half. And then, and I made this. I wrote this independent movie that played at some festivals and stuff. And then when I moved to New York, I tried it for a little while, and I just didn't like it. Like I was like, oh, this thing that kind of has just made me miserable, it's not doing it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I can be happy. I don't need it. And there's, I just do have a feeling of like, I'm very grateful to UCB, just in terms of like the thing that sort of show business sort of killed in me. I kind of thought like, oh, I'm just done with that. Like I kind of figured I was done performing. And it wasn't until I started like realizing like, oh, there's this place that does these great shows. And I started taking classes. That was what really like enlivened it, like awakened something in me that had been dead for the better part of a decade.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's that story.
Yeah.
I'm eager to work with him again. See if we can make it happen.
Yeah, do you feel any kind of lingering residual resentment?
Not really. I mean,
rejection happens all the time in this business. And
felt bad that just the way it was handled, because I would have preferred it had been an honest thing as opposed to it felt a little bit like they were talking around it, that I was auditioning rather than that I already had the job.
Mm-hmm.
So there was an element of like, I felt like I could have. If there had been one gesture of like, hey, listen, it's not personal, or something, if there had been one thing like that, it probably would have eliminated any bad feeling from it. Yeah. I would have still been disappointed, but then again, I also know that I was probably one of 100 problems when you're trying to recreate World War II on a cable TV budget.
Yeah,
yeah.
But no, I go see Tom Hanks movies all the time. I just saw Captain Phillips. It's really good.
Yeah.
What's Dead Eyes?
I've seen it in things I've done since then. There's times when it's just like the eyes don't look very lively.
Does this explain the avatar of you on your Tumblr?
That has no eyes in it?
Yeah, your Tumblr account is a little orphan Annie drawing of you with no pupils.
It probably does explain it, but I've never thought of it until now. Oh. So I think it's nice we've reached a breakthrough.
I guess we should wrap. That feels like a good closing
point.
Yeah,
that's a good place to
I'm just
going to
say what I wish we could have talked about, which was lots of improv nerd approaches, because you're so natural. That's an inadvertently condescending word, but it does feel like, for all your talk of having scenes in your pocket, I guess this is one thing I want to talk about.
For
all your talk about having like scenes in your back pocket, and I also know that you were so intimidated by remembering things from the opening that you started eating almonds every morning to improve your memory. Is that true?
Yeah, I did do that. At one point, it was pointed out to me that when I was on Herald Night, I would eat 8 almonds every morning.
Yeah.
And then it was pointed out to me later that it's like, I was thinking like, oh, like 8 Herald team members, and it's just like a good amount. And then it was pointed out to me like, are you eating them like in effigy? Like, have you like assigned like,
yeah,
this one's Dan Black?
Yeah, this is Mujan. This is Matt Mayer.
Yeah. And, but I was doing that because I was thinking like, I can't remember stuff from the opening.
Mm-hmm.
But you've come from there to be like, when you play, it feels to me like you just step out and throw yourself into scenes,
yeah,
not with reckless abandon, but certainly like with a carefree air.
Totally, yeah, and I can agree with that from having done Torco shows with you. It just, there's a confidence and a simplicity to your initiations.
Yeah,
your play.
The things that I was worried about early on, I kind of worked through a lot of those just through the process of just getting reps in and doing classes and stuff like that. So like stuff like that, I don't worry about, but also I've only been nervous doing improv, I think, once or twice in very specific circumstances,
uh-huh,
but I've never been nervous doing it. And I've never, like, I feel bad. Like I made an incorrect literary reference a month ago in a Stepfather show.
Which one?
I made a reference.
The Tom Clancy one?
No, it was in that scene. It was going really well. And then someone mentioned Elizabeth Gilbert. And in my mind, I...
The Gone Girl?
Yeah, I transposed Elizabeth Gilbert with Gillian Flynn. And I instantly knew I'd done it wrong. And I still feel like bad about it. But I don't.
Only on the Stepfathers would that even be a concern.
But I don't feel like, I do not ever feel like genuinely bad. Even after I've done very poor improv. It bothers me, and I take it seriously, but I always, like, whenever I see people who feel like emotionally bad, I always feel like there's other things. If you're going to feel horrible after doing improv, then I think you should go work in a shelter instead or do something that's like, actually has a, you know.
Worth that energy.
Yeah. I feel like it's such a gift to be able to do this stuff.
Yeah.
That I always feel like it's a shame when I see someone who's like not enjoying it or not appreciating like how great it is.
Right. Yeah.
But I also, like, in terms of, there's a lot of stuff I still feel like I don't understand, and there's a part of me that almost has a feeling of, like, at this point, I don't know whether I will understand. Like, some of it's just mysterious to me.
Yeah.
Like what?
I don't understand how some of it works. Like, I don't, like, sometimes I'll do stuff and I'm like, oh, that was a second beat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And second beats in game really. That makes you a little knock-kneed or whatever. That makes you.
I have a pretty good handle on all of it, so I can kind of address any concerns.
Some people
has.
Do have a real clear sense of like, oh, and then we did this, and I went analogous with this. Very often, I just don't know what's happening. I just go out and figure like, oh, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, yeah. You sort of just go out and like, well, I remember the first beat had this kind of tone or this kind of energy or something to it, or
yeah.
You know.
But yeah, I mean, it is. Some people have a really good mathematical mind for it. I feel a little bit almost like hippy dippy about it sometimes.
Me
that
too.
It's like,
yeah,
that it's just like something happens and it's kind of magical.
Yeah.
and that's what's, I mean, it's nice to always be surprised by it. Like, I feel like that's, I don't know. It's mysterious.
I'm good.
Okay.
Keaton
has a question.
What? What was that back pocket scene?
Oh, yeah. I will tell you. The pocket scene, I will reveal it now, but this also could ruin me because I won't have it anymore. My back pocket scene was that I would initiate with, you probably shouldn't have hired me for your kid's birthday party.
Oh, that's a good start, yeah.
Yeah. I felt like when I was thinking of what it was going to be, I thought, I bet I could pull that from a lot of suggestions. Like, I felt like that's a good scene, and I bet a lot of suggestions
would work. Yeah.
And even ones that could stretch it, like food suggestions.
Yeah, you can work it in there easy.
You can work it in somehow.
Yeah.
That was, but now I can't use it. I'll think of a new one. There's something. Yeah.
All right.
Also, I'm on Stone Cold Fox, not Gramps.
Oh, Jesus. Right.
Wow, we're out of practice.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ratliff.
Yeah, thank you.
We didn't talk about being in Stone Cold Fox. We didn't talk about your fake presidential campaign where you campaigned just on the basis of being old enough to run.
Right. Yeah. And your current Olympic campaign.
That's right.
Or your lone cornmeal machine where you and did those beautiful
short
animated
films and
art
cartoons.
I would have someone in the podcast just for that.
Yeah.
And we didn't really detail your obsessiveness. We didn't talk about
Elvis Costello
enough, or just hilarious Connor anecdotes of insane things you've done on stage.
Don't you have an anecdote from that Paul McCartney thing about meeting Elvis Costello or about actually talking to?
Yeah, I was at a show in London that was a member of the Brodsky Quartet was doing a night of songs of Elvis Costello. And I thought, oh, I bet Costello will show up and be a surprise guest in the show because I knew he was in town for another tribute concert that I wasn't going to.
Right.
And I sat in the front row, and I looked around, and Costello was coming in, and he sat basically next to me, but a little behind me because of the way the seats were. So I could only see him peripherally, but I couldn't look back without him noticing. He was right next to me.
Yeah.
And then the concert was one of the members of the string quartet singing the songs, and he was not a strong singer. And
yeah.
He was very nervous. His hands were shaking holding a yeah. sheet. And they had another guy who would alternate singing songs with this guy who was like an actor who would like speak the songs rather than sing the yes. songs. And I was like, oh God, I don't know how to react to this concert because I don't know if I'm like, I don't like this. Maybe Costello likes it.
Yeah.
And then that's rude. But if I look like I like it, maybe Costello hates it.
Yeah.
And I look like an idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so for the whole concert, I was like very aware of like, oh, I'm sitting right next to Elvis Costello and I don't like this concert.
Yeah.
And I'm mad that all these songs were written by the guy who's perfect to sing them, who's sitting right here. Like you could just jump up on stage
yeah.
and this would be the greatest show
yeah.
in town.
Yeah.
He got up and sang one song at the end. That's really tense. Like, just imagine any yeah. singer that you like. Imagine going to a show, sitting next to them in a weird way where they're kind of just behind you.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
watching other people ruin the songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For 90 minutes.
Yeah. That is nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
And very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Thank you, Connor, for being yeah. on the show.
Thanks for having
Thank
me.
Thank you, Connor. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Sypha.
Thank you, Keaton. Thank you, Sypha.
Thank you.
That's the end of the episode. Please come back another time when there'll be more.
Yes, there will be more.
Yes.
Okay.
Bye. That massive prison of all the pleasures of our